You're listening to The Space Show with Andrew Rennie. For only the second time in its 50-year history, NASA now has a plan for a decade of planetary exploration. This plan was prepared by scientists. In our first episode of our Space Show series about the Decadal Survey, we described the process by which the plan was reached. Our second episode revealed some of the missions it is proposed to send to the planets by 2022. This evening, in our final episode, we will describe the process by which NASA will decide what to do. Our guide is planetary scientist Steve Squires of Cornell University. He was announcing the plan at a conference of his colleagues. No planetary exploration is possible without mature, enabling technologies. For example, Steve Squires' own Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, needed airbag technology to land on Mars in 2004. Last year, the much larger Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity needed Skycrane technology for its landing. The second Decadal Survey recognizes this and supports new technology development.
Before, I mentioned the importance of a technology program. Okay, we have in our report in Chapter 11 some specific, precise recommendations regarding the technologies to invest in. It is important that these technologies be linked, since the money's coming out of your budget, Jim, to the missions that you want to fly in the planetary division. And so we particularly emphasize mission technology development that is linked to a Titan Saturn system mission. This is a very high priority mission from the Outer Planet Satellites group. It didn't rise to the same level as Europa in our study, but it's clearly a high priority and an area where there should be some technology development. Technology specific to the Neptune mission. If Uranus doesn't happen and we get downstream and we can choose between Uranus and Neptune, Neptune could be a fine choice. And then there are two more missions, the sample return lander and the sample return orbiter. In that sample return campaign, there are important technologies needed there. For example, the Mars Ascent vehicle that's going to blast those samples off the surface and put them into orbit around Mars.
In his address, Squires showed the scientists charts of current and projected future space budgets.
Okay, let me show you some budget charts. So this is what we've called the cost-constrained program. The black line that you see here, that black line is the same as that red wedge that I showed you at the beginning. That was the target we were hoping to kind of hit. Taking these colorful curves, we'll go from the bottom up. The blue one at the bottom, that's the RNA program. And you see it increasing at the level that we recommend. Yellow, that's Discovery. It starts off low because we've got Discovery missions in development now, but then it grows out to the level that we suggested. The black and the gray, that's the technology program. The big fat orange one there, that's Max-C. And that's Max-C at $2.5 billion. Max-C at $3.5, do the math. It totally busts the curve. You can't do it. You got no way of getting there. So that's Max-C at $2.5. The two purple ones, that's New Frontiers 4 and New Frontiers 5. And then the green one is the beginning of a Uranus mission. Where's Europa? There's Europa. That's Europa at $4.7. You can see why we feel it is so imperative that NASA find a way to de-scope that mission and bring the cost down to something reasonable. It is a fabulous mission. But at 4.7, it's an intractable problem that needs to get fixed.
With so many good and worthwhile proposals to choose from, some clear and fair rules are needed to reach decisions on which projects should be approved.
I talked about decision rules. What happens if the funding is less? What happens if we don't get the black line in that plot? Our recommendation is that the first thing NASA do, if the funding is less, is de-scope or delay flagship missions. If we get into a program where the only missions that we are flying are flagships, that return data in 10 years or 15 years or get the samples back in 20 years, that leads to an unacceptable stagnation of our program. We must preserve discovery. We must preserve new frontiers. So the first thing to go after is the flagships. And that was what our community told us emphatically. We should slip new frontiers or discovery missions only if adjustments to the flagships can't solve the problem. And throughout any process like this, NASA should place high priority on preserving RNA and technology development funding. That wording was chosen very carefully. It doesn't say that those two are absolutely sacrosanct, but it stresses the great importance to the health of our discipline of RNA and technology. So let's just follow this through. What happens in the face of what might be declining budgets? We say protect RNA, protect technology, protect discovery, and protect new frontiers. So let's look at MAX-C. We recommend that NASA fly a 2018 NASA ESA Mars mission only if two conditions are met. One is that the cost to NASA is no more than 2.5, and based on the work that we did, we truly believe that there's a good mission in there at 2.5. And the other is that it leads realistically to sample return. A mission that sends another rover, another MER-class rover, to run around and pick up samples and take some pictures, but doesn't get those samples back, does not rise to the level of importance that makes it our top flagship. So there's got to be a pathway to sample return, and that probably means preserving that partnership with ESA. If it turns out that for whatever reason, technology's not ready, partnership with ESA falls apart, whatever, if Mars 18 does not meet these criteria, then the second priority is JEO. There's no recommended plan B for Mars. Okay? If you can't afford JEO, if JEO can't be descoped from that 4.7 down to something we can actually swallow, then the third priority is the Uranus orbiter and probe, and that one costs out at a whopping $2.7 billion. So it ain't cheap either. If that's not affordable, and this is why we have those two other flagships in there, there's a Venus climate mission at $2.4 billion and an Enceladus orbiter mission at $1.9 billion. And if you can't afford any of those, you got no flagships at all.
By the way, Steve Squires referred there to a mission called JEO, GEO. That is NASA jargon for Jupiter, Europa, Orbiter. That is the mission that would travel to the planet Jupiter and go into orbit around its moon Europa. Now, Europa is interesting because it is thought to have an ocean of water beneath its icy crust. It may even have life in this ocean. Well, no mission gets off the ground without a launch vehicle, what you and I call a rocket. Depending on the size, these can be very expensive, especially if you're going to the outer solar system.
Launch vehicle costs. This is a big concern. Launch vehicle costs were the reasons that we recommended restructuring the New Frontiers caps. Okay, launch vehicle costs are growing, they're very, very volatile, and it's a big threat to our planetary program. We recommend a couple of steps that could be taken to help reduce launch costs. One is dual manifesting. Look for opportunities to launch two vehicles together on the same rocket. There's risk involved in doing that, but there's also a benefit. Another is block buys across NASA, not just NASA Planetary, but across all of NASA of certain launch vehicles. Okay, NASA used to procure Delta II launch vehicles this way. If you buy them as a group, if you buy several at once, maybe you can get a deal. And then finally, there are critical technologies, and AeroCapture is a great example, that can be implemented and exploited to reduce substantially the mass of spacecraft and therefore reduce the performance and hence the cost of the launch vehicles that we use. So these are all things that maybe we can take advantage of, but fundamentally we got a problem here. And our reason for restructuring, recommending restructuring of the New Frontiers cap is because of that problem.
Missions to the rocky terrestrial planets have all been solar powered. That's because Mercury, Venus, the Moon, and Mars are all close to the Sun and its supply of energy. Missions to Jupiter and beyond have all been powered by the heat from decaying plutonium. I say all, save for Juno, which is currently on its way to Jupiter. New solar cell technology has made it possible to power this craft with solar energy. The Pioneer 10 and 11, Voyagers 1 and 2, Galileo, Cassini and New Horizons have all been powered by radioactive thermoelectric generators. The heat from disintegrating plutonium-238 atoms causes thermocouples to produce electricity. But, as Squires points out, the United States has not produced any new plutonium-238 for many years now. Without it, no outer planet missions will be possible.
Plutonium-238, this is another big issue. Okay, the amount of plutonium that we have for spacecraft power systems is dwindling alarmingly. And unless NASA and the Department of Energy can get their act together via the congressional process to restart plutonium-238 production, it's ultimately going to be impossible for NASA to do any missions to the deep outer solar system. You need this thing for a long-lived lunar seismic network. There's a 14-day lunar night. Now, one thing that we think can be done to really help this problem is to place greater emphasis on the development of the ASRG, the Advanced Stirling Radioisotope Generator. This is a device that is able to produce power from plutonium-238 at a factor of 3 or 4 higher efficiency. Okay, so it dramatically reduces the amount of plutonium that you need. We recommend that JEO switch to ASRGs now. Okay, and include that in any descope version of the mission because it reuses so much less plutonium. The thing about these ASRGs, though, is they're complicated little machines. They've got lots of moving parts, and they have not been proven out as something that can last the 15 or 20 year timescales that might be associated with some of these deep space missions. So this is one of our highest priority recommended technologies, and we would like to see ASRG development given a level of attention comparable to what you give to a flight project. They're so important.
Ever since the advent of the space age, an argument has raged about the pros and cons of manned versus robotic space exploration. The truth is, we need both. They can also complement each other. The Decadal Survey discusses the interaction between NASA's manned spaceflight and unmanned exploration programs.
Interaction with NASA's human exploration program. Now, this, of course, is a rapidly evolving situation. Okay, but looking at it realistically, the bodies that we're going to be sending humans to in the foreseeable future are limited to some planetary objects, particularly the moon, asteroids, and Mars, and the moons of Mars. Now, we have missions, recommended missions via New Frontiers, via the Discovery Program, via the flagships, to all of these objects. When we have a peer-reviewed NASA planetary mission to one of these objects, we feel that it is an imperative to maintain the science focus of such missions. In particular, what we don't want to see happen is, let's say a proposal team proposes a mission to one of these objects, a New Frontiers mission, they write their proposal, they get it in, they get it accepted, and then after all that, the human exploration folks show up with a bunch of new requirements and maybe not enough money to pay for them. That's the kind of situation we want to avoid. Now, that sounds very negative, but I will also point out that there's a wonderful recent example of a partnership between the exploration part of NASA and the planetary part of NASA, and that's LRO. Okay, that's an ESMD. That's an exploration mission. It was carried out using scientific instruments that were well-planned, well-designed, well-calibrated, did its exploration-related goals. Operations has now been handed over to NASA CODES, and it's producing terrific science with a wonderful set of instruments. So these partnerships with ESMD can be very successful if they're crafted well at the start, as LRO was.
Planetary exploration is not just a matter of sticking a probe on top of a rocket and shooting it off through the solar system. For example, astronomical observations are needed to figure out where the target planet or asteroid is. Without that information, it would be impossible to navigate a craft there. And what to do with the data or that the probe or orbiter will send back? The data needs to be stored, then analysed to turn it into information. This may take years, long after the spacecraft itself has ceased to function. The costs associated with this may equal or exceed the price tag of the probe itself. One of NASA's storage systems is called the Planetary Data System, or PDS. The second Decadal Survey for Planetary Exploration addresses these and related issues.
Supporting NASA activities, I won't go through this in a whole lot of detail. We recommend continuation and upgrading of the Planetary Data System. We recommend roughly 1% of the cost of each flight project be set aside for education and outreach. We recommend continued NASA support for telescope facilities, IRTF, Keck, Goldstone, Arecibo, the VLBA. Expand the capabilities of the Deep Space Network, and we have specific recommendations regarding the communications bands for uplink and downlink. And for there's sample return missions coming. And we recommend that when NASA plan these sample return missions, they take into account the full cost of receiving and curating those samples when planning these missions. That doesn't mean that the projects pay for those costs, but it means that the most important science gets done after the missions get back to Earth, after the samples get back to Earth. You got to keep that in mind. And we recommend that NASA establish a program of instrument development for these future sample return missions. For the National Science Foundation, NSF supports many observatories that are important to planetary astronomy. We recommended continued support of those observatories. The Office of Polar Programs supports a lot of important work in Antarctica, both terrestrial Mars analog studies, planetary analog studies, and importantly, collection of meteorites. We recommended that continue. We recommend expanded NSF funding for laboratory research in planetary science. Now, let me tell you something. Okay, I briefed our report, Dale Cruikshank was there to help me do it, to the National Science Foundation. One of the things they said back to me is, look, we'd love to support planetary research, but we need to get proposals from your community. And not just proposals where you scratch out NASA on the cover page and write in NSF. Okay? So it is important, if we want to make these recommendations, it's important that our community actually follow up with good proposals. Finally, and very importantly, there's this Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, LSST. This is a ground-based facility that is being developed for a variety of different causes, some of them, many of them, astrophysical. But it's a facility that has enormous potential for doing planetary science, particularly the science of primitive bodies. And so we came out very strongly in support of completion of LSST and its use for planetary science.
Now, sometimes, no matter how important and worthwhile a proposed mission is, there just isn't the money available to fund it. The scientific and engineering teams involved could throw up their hands in despair and give up. Steve Squires reminded us that there is another alternative.
I got two more things to say. Here's the first. I've said a lot tonight about descopes and how important it is that we descope some of these missions. Descoping is a difficult thing. Descoping requires discipline. It requires giving up some of our most cherished hopes for what a mission might be like. It's a hard thing to do. But let me remind you about two of my favorite descoped missions. Okay, there was once a mission called the Grand Tour. It was big, it was aggressive, it was comprehensive, it took advantage of a once in more than a century alignment of the outer planets. It was too much. Couldn't afford it. It got descoped massively. It became something we all know as Voyager. Some of you will also remember that there was once a mission called VOIR, Venus Orbiting Imaging Radar. Spectacular mission with radar to map the surface of Venus. Big, complicated, aggressive. Again, too much. Massively descoped. That mission became Magellan. Two massively descoped missions, Voyager and Magellan, and between them, they revolutionized our understanding of five planets. Okay, so descoping, when it's done right, can lead to great missions.
In his concluding remarks about the second decadal survey, Steve Squires uses the term OMB. This venerable American arm of government is the Office of Management and Budget. The rough Australian equivalent is the Treasury, which does economic analyses of government programs. Squires also refers to Jim Green. He is the director of the Planetary Science Division of NASA's Science Mission Directorate. He acts as a sort of gatekeeper, come advocate, within NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Okay, here's my final point, and this is probably the most important thing that I have to say to you tonight. Okay, I showed you this budget earlier. This budget is a projection by OMB of what the future of planetary exploration might look like. Now, if that budget were actually implemented, it would mean the end of flagship class science at NASA in the planetary program. But this budget, this is just the first step in a long process. This is not set in stone by any means. I mean, the language that comes with this from OMB, even that language says that it's notional. Okay? Now, this budget is the first step in the process from the executive branch of the government. NASA works for the executive branch. Jim Green works for NASA. And when Jim Green is handed this budget, his job is to go off and figure out how to implement it. But there's a lot more to the process than that. There's the legislative part. And that's a big part of the budget process, too. And the legislative branch of the government, the Congress, is answerable to its constituents, and those constituents include us. So those of us who care about planetary exploration have not just the right, but I believe the obligation to speak to our congressional representatives about the planetary budget and to make it very clear what program we would like to see. Now, the timing here is exquisite. This budget just came out a few weeks ago, and at virtually the exact moment that we get handed this budget projecting possibly the decline of planetary science in this country, at the same moment, we as a community have produced the decadal report. This arose from our community. It has the full weight of the National Research Council behind it. And that counts for a lot in Washington, D.C. Okay, this is a report that clearly articulates a compelling program of planetary exploration that includes flagship class science. Okay, so we have the opportunity here with this report to use this as a rallying point and to speak together as a community with one voice in support of Jim Green's and our program of planetary exploration. If we do not speak up, then there is some chance that we'll see a program like the one represented by this budget and all that it implies. But if we can speak together with a single voice, reach out to our congressional representatives in support of this NRC plan for planetary exploration, I think we have a good chance of getting the kind of program that we all really want to see. Thank you.
Steve Squires, a planetary scientist at Cornell University, announcing the second decadal plan for the United States planetary exploration. And this has been the concluding part in this space show series about plans proposed for the coming decade. This series was researched, written, and produced by Andrew Rennie.